The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Joe Biden keeps warning us about the specter of segregationists, but he neglects to tell us that those were his buddies, and moreover, virtually all the segregationists came from the Democratic Party. I'll tell you more. Interestingly, that letter from the School Board Association that led to the Biden administration creating a task force against terrorism to do surveillance on parents, that was solicited in the first place by the Biden administration. I'll give you the implications. Julie Kelly is going to join me. We're going to talk about Ray Epps and the FBI's role in January 6th. These are topics covered in her new book called January 6th. And finally, I'll continue my exploration of Russian literature and actually address a question by a reader who goes, why are you talking about the Russians? They're such horrible people. They've killed millions of people. So I'm going to answer that question in the context of why I'm beginning this exploration of the major writers of Russia. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I went back and listened to Joe Biden's speech in Georgia. The devil went down to Georgia. And here was Biden railing about segregation. He's railing about the specter of segregationist George Wallace, the originator of the notorious phrase, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And Biden left the clear impression that these segregationists could all be found in the Republican Party. And his idea was, let's not continue this horrible Republican tradition of segregation. Now, Biden didn't say all that, but he implied it. And he did name specifically the segregationists, and he named Wallace in particular. But what he didn't tell you is that the segregationists were his buddies. Biden earlier boasted that earlier in his career boasted that he knows these guys. They were great guys. He worked with them. He found common cause with them. They actually regarded him as a kind of protege. So interestingly, all of this has now become erased, not just with Biden himself doing it, but with the media sort of colluding in it. And what Biden also didn't tell you is that the segregationists were Democrats. And this goes all the way back to the aftermath of the Civil War. The very people, the Brennan Center has put out a long list of, you know, civil rights bills that were blocked by segregationists. But again, the Brennan Center, this left-wing organization, doesn't tell you that those segregationists were Democrats. They were Democrats to the core. There's virtually one or two examples of a segregationist Democrat who became a Republican. Strom Thurmond is an example of one who did. But when Thurmond became a Republican, he wasn't promoting segregation at all. Now, what about George Wallace? Well, George Wallace was a Democrat. He was a segregationist. He briefly left the Democratic Party to run as an independent. He thought it might be a better way for him to try to get to the presidency. But when that failed, interestingly, he didn't become a Republican. He went right back to the Democratic Party, and he stayed a Democrat until his death. So this is the point that you get the false teaching here and the false implication from the left that these segregationists became Republicans. And the fact of the matter is the vast, vast majority of them stayed loyal Democrats right into their graves. So Democrats have been the party of voter suppression. And I want to argue that they're doing it now. They haven't stopped doing voter suppression. Just the mechanism of voter suppression is different. Before, it used to be, let's stop blacks from voting. And the way we do that is we impose, you know, poll taxes on them, or we unleash the Ku Klux Klan on them so that they are terrified and don't want to be seen at the polls because they know there are going to be people who are going to be noting that they were there who will then do a night ride and beat them up at night. So this was their old strategy. Their new strategy is, in a sense, to try to make it easy for people to vote unlawfully and thus cancel out legal votes. So this is a new, different strategy for voter suppression. But let's remember, this is voter suppression all the same. When aliens, not just illegal aliens, even legal aliens aren't allowed to vote, if legal aliens or illegal aliens vote, if underage students vote, if ineligible felons vote, if persons who haven't voted moved out of state vote, all these people are canceling out lawful votes. That is voter suppression. Now, although the Democrats say they're really worried that there are minorities and poor people who can't vote, think about this. Have they ever produced a single case of a person who goes, you know, I was really trying to vote in Mississippi, I was really trying to vote in Georgia, but I just couldn't. I was faced with all kinds of obstacles. How many cases of this have you seen on the news or in the media? Not a single one. Why? Because the Democrats can't produce a single case. Not one.
Everybody so can get an ID.
Anyone can get an ID, but no one's stopping anyone from voting. I mean, that's the point. So when the Democrats talk about attacks on democracy and so on, you have to view this kind of skeptically with a little bit of jaundice. See, here's Jennifer Rubin, this is the most sycophantic journalist in America. Basically, all Biden has to do is pull down his diapers, and there's Jen Rubin ready to do the needful. Well, my point is Jen Rubin will change her position depending on she's just absolutely slavish in her devotion. It's almost comical. She's sort of like a battered wife who keeps coming back, for more. And here's Jen Rubin. Democracy's fate rests with two stubborn senators whose sole concern is their standing with conservatives at home. Now, let's wait for a minute. What is Jen Rubin accusing Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin of? She's accusing them of being responsive to their own constituents at home. In other words, far from accusing them of violating democracy, they're actually exercising democracy. They are the elected representatives of moderate to conservative states. They're reflecting those sentiments, and Jen Rubin is castigating them for doing that. She wants them to ignore their constituents and go with Joe Biden. She's basically like, Joe Biden's pulled down his diapers, I'm right here, come on Joe Manchin, come on Kristen Sinema, you join me. And the thing about Biden is that his arguments are unbelievably specious. One of the best examples he could come up with of voter suppression is that, I'll quote him, Georgia won't let you give food to people waiting in line to vote. I'm thinking, wait a minute. We're first of all a nation that has kind of gone massively obese. I mean, you look at all kinds of studies that show that we're Americans almost twice the size that they used to be. Is it really true that let's just say it's a long line, I'm going to have to wait for 2 hours in line. I got to eat. Really? Is it going to kill you if you don't eat while you're waiting in line? Is it really necessary to ply you with food while you're waiting in line? This is absolutely ridiculous. So here you've got a president posing as the champion of democracy. First of all, his poll rating is a miserable 33%, so there's some democratic repudiation for you. He's trying to change the Senate rules. These are longstanding Senate rules, part of our system, the filibuster. This is the organization of the Senate. Basically says that you need supermajorities. And if not, you can't, so they want to get rid of the filibuster so that a mere majority, and think of it, this is the merest of majorities. They'll have to bring in Kamala Harris to break the tie, and that's supposed to be the true expression of democracy. No. That's not democracy. This is a party with a very narrow claw hold on power, trying to use its window of opportunity to change, to transform the playing field, to unlevel the playing field, you might say, not in order to protect democracy, but in order to undermine it. People make all kinds of grandiose New Year resolutions, but here's a simple one. I need new towels. But here's the problem. If you go out and buy towels, the normal, ordinary towels don't really dry you very well anymore. They feel kind of soft and lotiony in the store. You take them home, they don't absorb. Why not? Because towel companies typically import the product, then add softeners that make the towels feel good, but they don't dry you very well. Now, Mike Lindell, CEO of MyPillow, has solved this problem. He founded the best towel company right here in the USA. They have proprietary technology to create towels that feel soft and actually work. They're made with USA Cotton. They come with the MyPillow 60-day money-back guarantee. And for a limited time, Mike is offering a really good deal on the 6-piece towel set. It includes 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, 2 washcloths, all made with USA Cotton, soft yet absorbent, regularly $109.99 and now $39.99. Call 800-876-0227. That's 800-876-0227. Or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code DINESH Dinesh. Remember the story of the National School Board Association writing a letter to the Biden administration worrying about threats to school board members and teachers posed by parents, upon which the Biden administration sprang into action and Merrick Garland and the DOJ set up a task force to essentially do surveillance of parents, to treat parents, so to speak, as domestic terrorists. Well, at that time, there was a whole army of media figures. I'm looking here at posts in the AP, the Washington Post, and PolitiFact, all denying that the Biden administration was labeling parents as domestic terrorists. Let me now quote. Here's PolitiFact. Parents who challenge school curriculums are domestic terrorists. Here's their idiotic fact-truth-o-meter. False. Here is the AP. Posts mischaracterized school board organization's letter to Biden, an AP assessment, false. Notice here that the AP is very clear that this was a school board-initiated letter and the Biden administration just responding to it. And then similarly, fact checker at the Washington Post, the false GOP claim that the Justice Department is spying on parents at school board meetings. Well, here's a very interesting development. Based on the Freedom of Information Act, there are now some emails that have come out that reveal very clearly that the Biden administration solicited this letter from the National School Board Association in the first place. So let's think about the implications. The Biden administration wants to create a task force to tag and label parents as domestic terrorists, to do surveillance of parents. So they say, listen, in order for this to seem legit, why don't we twist the arm of the National School Board Association to produce that letter, and then we will pretend to be responding to something that has come from the outside. Now, even in this case, what they did was they went to the president of the National School Board Association and offered her a coveted government position. So there was kind of a quid pro quo, kind of a bribe. Listen, you write this letter that we want, and we'll kind of reward you by giving you a position in the administration. So how does this all come out? It actually comes out almost kind of by accident. There's an email where someone is writing to a woman named Christy Sweat, who is part of the National School Board Association. And this person who's writing says, I'm very concerned about the process by which the statement, meaning the letter, was issued, and the tone that allowed the White House to direct the Attorney General to consider members of our community domestic terrorists. And so replying to this email, Christy Sweat writes, Hi, Marnie. And then she goes on to say, she basically says that this letter came, quote, from a request by Secretary Cordona. Boom. Secretary Cordona is, of course, the education secretary. This is the guy who used to be the head of Connecticut's School Board Association, but is now the Biden administration's man in education. So Secretary Cordona solicits the letter, they send the letter, they reward the woman who orchestrated the letter, and then they set up this task force. The clearer meaning of this is they wanted to set up the task force anyway. They wanted to do this. This was not simply something that was kind of imposed on them because of any kind of external pressure. It was actually part of a plan. And what this really shows is that the Biden administration at the highest level, we're talking about the level of the cabinet secretary, Secretary Cordona, Attorney General Merrick Garland, who has in effect a cabinet position. These are the people who are trying to not just demonize, but I would say criminalize the political opposition. They want to send a kind of chilling message to parents. Don't become too active, because if you get too noisy at a school board meeting, if you say things like, you people need to be out of here, we're going to treat you as a potential terrorist because you might be inciting violence against teachers. So essentially free speech, the passionate expression of statements that, by the way, are legal, become targeted here as some form of unlawful incitement. The Biden administration here was not simply reacting to something done by the school board. They were the ones who got the whole thing started. We all know that in order to keep our immune system strong, we need extra protection for it. Now, my friends at Centurion Labs have combined 5 key ingredients to defend your immune system against allergies, colds, the flu, and, of course, coronavirus. It's called Centurion Defender. It incorporates vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, copper, and quercetin in just one capsule. No more swallowing 10 pills a day or not taking supplements because the individual cost is too high. Debbie and I currently take just one Defender with breakfast and one Defender with dinner, and this definitely keeps the germaphobe in our family happy. Just like the Centurions of Rome, led by example, held themselves to the highest possible standards, Centurion Labs has dedicated the last 15 years to research and develop safe, effective, and affordable purchase of healthcare products made in the USA that you can trust. For a limited time, listeners of this podcast can save 20% off their first order of Centurion Defender when you visit centurionlabs.com/Dinesh and use the promo code Dinesh. Defend your health today with Centurion Defender. Go to centurionlabs.com/Dinesh. Once again, centurionlabs.com/Dinesh. Guys, I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast my favorite journalist, Julie Kelly, the heroine of the January 6th reporting. Julie has, Julie writes for American Greatness, but she has an important and best-selling new book out. It's just called January 6th, and I'm going to read the subtitle, How Democrats Use the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, welcome back. Delighted to have you, as always. You were just at a hearing, and tell us all about it.
So thank you, Dinesh, for having me on, and I know we'll talk a little bit about my book. But there was just a hearing this morning on Thursday morning related to the case of Ryan Samsel, who has been in jail, arrested last January 30th. And it's important because this ties into the Ray Epps controversy that we've been seeing for the past several days. Ryan Samsel is the man who Ray Epps whispered in his ear right before Ryan Samsel becomes the first Trump supporter, first Capitol protester to breach the initial lines at the perimeter of the grounds that day. He has been, as I said, arrested and detained since last January. The government continues to delay his case. He wasn't even formally indicted by grand jury until August. What DOJ is doing now to delay his trial, and what I believe is to delay revealing what happened with Ray Epps, because of course it was a critical point right before the breach, is delaying his trial. They've added defendants to his case. And the judge, Judge Tim Kelly, again today, delayed for the next few weeks until January 27th. Another status hearing is DOJ adds defendants, adds indictments, and then claims they need to add more discovery. This is just part of DOJ's gamesmanship in delaying as much as they can what happened on January 6th and specifically related to any sort of government informants or assets that were used in the Capitol breach.
Julie, do you think it's going to be important, and in fact, will this happen, that a January 6th defendant or defendant say, listen, I'm not going to take these plea bargains. I'm going to put the case on trial. And in doing so, I'm going to put the government on trial. Because how are we going to get a full window into what happened if we don't let the adversary process play out and the government is able to intimidate these defendants into taking pleas?
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening, Dinesh, and I've seen this numerous times over the last few months, especially, is you have detained defendants. You have now more than 80 defendants who are detained, including Ryan Samsel, including other men who are approaching now 1 year in jail, not convicted of any crime, pretrial detention orders, and the government, Joe Biden's DOJ, keeps delaying then discovery obligations. They keep adding defendants. They keep adding new charges. They keep adding new indictments. And so this is part of the way to, I think, squeeze them into finally accepting plea deals. I'm not so sure that the government is that satisfied with their plea deal arrangements. Most of the pleas in the January 6th investigation relate to Class B misdemeanors, such as parading in the Capitol. They are not getting, with a few exceptions, these high profile plea deals that they want. And so I think this is a way to squeeze these defendants so they don't have to go to trial and they don't have to present all of the evidence, including the number of informants or assets involved in these specific cases in open court.
Julie, let's talk about Ray Epps, because when we heard ever since January 6th about instigation, right? Somebody is instigating the takeover of the Capitol. Now, they tried to say that Trump is the instigator, the other congressman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is the instigator. But I've only actually seen one instigator, and that's Ray Epps. Here's a guy saying, let's take the Capitol, let's go in there. And he's clearly mobilizing other people to do it. And in fact, what's so fascinating is at the time, there are people around him who suspect him of being a Fed, and they start shouting, Fed, Fed, Fed. So not only is that all revealing and interesting in its own right, but now you have a member, you have Adam Kinzinger, never Trumper, who is coming to the defense of Ray Epps and basically saying, Ray Epps is a good guy. Leave Ray Epps alone. How do you explain this peculiar turn of events in which they keep complaining about instigation and yet they are defending the one instigator that we can see on video instigating the so-called riot?
Right. It was really revealing to see this. All of a sudden, everybody sort of white knighting Ray Epps, including people like Adam Kinzinger, including reporters who I followed for a year, trying to destroy the lives of, you know, trespassers that day, calling them insurrectionists and wanting the government to throw the book at them. Suddenly you have someone not only just once implores people to go into the Capitol, but numerous times. And Dinesh, he also was in restricted area that day. He is photographed and video photographed in the same area where a number of defendants who never went into the Capitol, didn't attack police officers, weren't caught with a weapon. They were charged. Why is Ray Epps not charged? You actually see him in front of police lines. There's one video showing him helping people carry a huge sign towards a line of police on the west side of the building. If ever there was a case for someone, as you said, to be charged with inciting, conspiring, obstruction of an official proceeding, because of course he was there while the proceedings were actually going on. This is a felony count that DOJ has slapped against more than 220 people. Ray Epps doesn't even have an obstruction charge. So none of this makes sense. But then to see not only Adam Kinzinger, but the entire media complex, you know, sort of protecting Ray Epps and just explaining away why he hasn't been charged and laughing off the idea that he's some sort of government informant or asset certainly should bolster suspicions that he is.
And isn't it true, Julie, that although we focus on Ray Epps, we also have Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers. And Stuart Rhodes is another guy who was basically in direct communication with a whole bunch of other guys who were charged. In their charging documents, it refers to Stuart Rhodes told him to do this, Stuart Rhodes told him to do that. And yet the kingmaker, Stuart Rhodes, is not charged at all. And then when you turn to the Proud Boys, you get something of the same story, which is some of the so-called leaders of the Proud Boys have apparently been working with the FBI. So what we seem to be getting here, and I just want you to summarize this for a moment because we'll go into it in depth in the next segment. Isn't it true that we've got a ring of high, it's not just one suspicious character, but a ring of suspicion that strongly points to considerable federal involvement in January 6th?
Yes, we do. So as you pointed out, Stuart Rhodes is person one, and now this 20 person co-defendant conspiracy case against Oath Keepers, including people who committed no violent crime. Most of the Oath Keepers did commit no violent crime. But you have person one, Stuart Rhodes, who's the alleged founder of the Oath Keepers, doesn't even face a trespassing charge, certainly is not involved in this conspiracy charge. He also was at the Capitol that day. Ray Epps is also connected to the Oath Keepers, the Arizona chapter. So the question now, Dinesh, is not so much who is being charged, but who has not been charged. And the fact that not only you have the lead conspirator in the Oath Keepers case, but also in the Proud Boys case, Enrique Terrio, who conveniently was arrested on January 4th and told not to go into the city the next day. That just seems like an odd thing. He was charged with a weapons violation. He also is person one in the Proud Boys indictments. he also has not been charged. And we know that he has worked with the FBI before. So this just is building a legitimate, valid case of not just FBI involvement, possible entrapment in many of these cases. And of course, the backstory to this is what we've also talked about, the Whitmer kidnapping case, which is quickly falling apart for the government, and how much the FBI concocted that, orchestrated it, executed it, and now the case is falling apart for DOJ.
Let's take a pause, Julie. When we come back, we're going to go into the Whitmer case and show the extent of FBI involvement and how that case is, as you say, crumbling. We'll be right back. You have homeowners insurance for a good reason, because without it, a fire, flood, or burglary could destroy you financially. But there's another major crime your homeowner's policy doesn't cover. It's called home title fraud. The FBI calls title fraud one of the fastest growing crimes, and it can ruin you financially, which is why you need Home Title Lock. Title fraud happens when a criminal forges your signature on documents stating you sold your home to him. Then he takes out loans against your home and leaves you with the payments. You'll spend a fortune in legal fees trying to prove you didn't commit fraud. Now, Home Title Lock puts a barrier around your home's title. That's why Debbie and I bought it, to protect our home. Now, the instant they detect anyone, from a cyber thief, a renter, even a relative trying to forge their way onto your home's title, they help shut it down. Go to HomeTitleLock.com, register your address to see if you're already a victim, and enter promo code RADIO for your 60-day money-back guarantee. That's HomeTitleLock.com, promo code RADIO. I'm back with investigative writer Julie Kelly. She writes for American Greatness, and you got to get a copy of her new book. It's a bestseller already, but we want to put it to number one on the bestseller list. It's called January 6th. How Democrats Use the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, I was delighted to see you're actually giving a portion of your profits on the book to the Patriot Freedom Project. So, you know, here we have in Julie someone who's really committed to the cause, really committed to what she's writing about. And Julie, we were talking about the, you mentioned at the end, the Whitmer case, and how the Whitmer case is a sort of interesting forerunner for January 6th. And in fact, the FBI agent who supervised the Whitmer case was very interestingly then transferred to D.C. and apparently given an important position in the January 6th investigation. Talk about how the Whitmer case, talk about the degree of FBI involvement and how the case is falling apart.
I mean, Dinesh, you could not, if you tried, write fiction about an FBI plot than we have in the Whitmer case. So you have at least one FBI informant or agent, including undercover agents, per defendant in this case. What they did was they lured people into this kidnapping scheme. They concocted it. They organized and paid for all of the optics related to this that's now used as evidence, surveillance trips, training trips, rifle trips, how to build a mock-up of her cottage. And so this was completely led by the FBI field office in Detroit. The top three FBI agents, however, had been removed from the case, removed from the government's witness list before the trial starts on March 8th. The top FBI agent who signed the initial federal criminal complaint has been fired by the FBI for beating up his wife. And the top, one of the top informants, the guy who organized all these trips, is a convicted felon, now accused of being a double agent, and committed at least two other crimes while he was working this kidnapping caper. So this not only is falling apart, but it's very illuminating once again to see the extent to which this FBI will go to entrap people on the right, to use it to target Donald Trump, which is exactly what it did, because the news was announced on October 8th of 2020. His voting was underway in Michigan. It led to all sorts of negative headlines about Trump. And now here we see the case falling apart. And as you said, the head of that field office was moved to the D.C. field office a week after the arrest announcements were made. So he's been there since the middle of October, then managing that office, which is handling all of the cases related to the January 6th FBI investigation.
Now, Julie, when the FBI embeds its agents in an operation like this, they generally like to say, listen, you know, these guys are plotting this horrible thing. We have our guys in there. So they've got to sort of pretend to be part of the operation because otherwise they will immediately fall under suspicion. But I think what's interesting is you quote in your book the fact that in a number of cases, the defendants could not afford to do the things that the FBI was trying to get them to do, so the FBI had to pay for it. And in some cases, defendants even pushed back against the FBI and said, listen, we don't want to do that, or we have no interest in that. And the FBI was like, yeah, you got to do it. So give an example or two of how the FBI, in a sense, made this operation occur, and it would not have occurred without FBI involvement by them pushing it forward.
The lead kidnapper, Adam Fox, was the guy hard on his luck who lived in the basement of his friend's vacuum shop. None of these men had any sort of means whatsoever. And so even when they were trying to organize these surveillance trips and they would say, look, we have no money. We don't even have a car. We can't go to, outside in Wisconsin and conduct a fake surveillance trip to prepare for the kidnapping. The FBI informants paid for everything. The lead informant was paid more than $50,000, given a new car, compensated for a loss when he sold his house for 6 months of work. And so the defense attorneys have really laid out in detail not only how they funded all of this, how they lured these men into the trap, into the FBI trap, but also just, they have almost 300 examples of communication between the informants and FBI agents that talk about how they were going to fight the resistance by these defendants to conduct this kidnapping plot. And so they've got a ton of evidence. They've asked to dismiss the case, defense attorneys, of course. I doubt the judge will, kind of hope that he doesn't, because we need this trial to go forward so we can get all of this information to the public. Because you know what, Dinesh? The national news media has completely memory holed this. You will not find one article in the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Politico. I just had a piece up this week. I went through all the major news organizations. There's not a single story about this Whitmer kidnapping keeper, even though it's completely scandalous and salacious. And any other time, it would be great front page headlines. But they have completely black-holed this and will not talk about this anywhere in the news media.
I mean, this is, Julie, I would say the indispensability of you. And of course, I think as a writer, it's in a way fortunate because you have the field all to yourself. You're doing reporting that is within the access of other people to do, but for ideological reasons, they won't do it. What I found fascinating is when one of the guys in the Whitmer kidnapping just says, we'll just make a demonstration and send the shells over to the media so they can see that we're tough guys. And the FBI goes, no, you got to go ahead with the kidnapping. So the point, Mick, here is that it's the FBI that is pushing a plot forward that would not have gone forward without them. And so the big question I think your book raises is, listen, what makes us think that they didn't use the same playbook, the same recipe on the national stage in January 6th? And I think it's you make the argument in the book that they did.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this started out with something called Operation Cold Snap, which was launched by the FBI in the spring of 2020 to infiltrate militia groups who were planning these anti-lockdown rallies. So this is how this was the justification to infiltrate these militia groups, one of whom in the Michigan kidnapping plot is also blamed for January 6th, the three percenters. We also know that there were informants in the Proud Boys. The New York Times has confirmed this. And now we know, thanks to Newsweek, and people who haven't read this really need to, an article posted a week ago Monday, contrary to testimony by Christopher Wray, the acting AG at the time, the DOJ and FBI had at least a half dozen elite FBI teams stationed at Quantico the weekend before January 6th, who knows what they were gaming out, and they deployed hundreds of these special forces to the Capitol early on January 6th, Capitol grounds and within the city. Well, Dinesh, what were they doing? We've seen tons of video from January 6th and photographs. I don't see anyone early in the day wearing ATF jackets or FBI gear to explain, to show to the crowd, here we are. They were all undercover. And that's why Tom Cotton asked this week, the DOJ, how many plainclothes officers or agents from DOJ were in the crowd or inside the building that day, and DOJ refused to answer.
Absolutely. And they've also, I think, refused to divulge the degree of FBI involvement in January 6th. I've seen a number of cases where they're asked point blank, most recently by Ted Cruz, about Ray Epps and about FBI involvement. And I think the very fact that they won't answer is itself their answer. It's very telling. It's very incriminating. Guys, you need to go out and get this book, January 6th by Julie Kelly. Hot off the press, must reading. Thanks, Julie, very much for coming on the podcast.
Dinesh, thank you so much, and thanks for helping me cover this whole issue.
Absolutely. I've been on Hillary Clinton's trail, as you know, for a long time. In my film Hillary's America, I detailed the dangers she posed to our country, and fortunately, the American people got the message. But there's a lot more to be done to reveal the ugly truth about the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and their corrupt ways, especially since Hillary isn't going away, and since the Biden family seems to view the Clintons' example as a sort of how-to guide. Now, you won't find the truth about Hillary in today's fake news media. You have to turn to a powerful source like Capital Research Center. My friends at Capital Research Center expose the left like no one else can. Now, they've released an eye-opening new report that lays bare the corruption of the Clinton crime family. It's called By Hook or By Crook. Want to read it? Then go to capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. You'll get the chance to order a free copy of By Hook or By Crook and learn the facts the mainstream media won't touch. So again, that's Capital Research, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. Check it out. I want to talk about the latest data on inflation. Now, I experienced inflation firsthand. When I first came to America, 1978, this was really in the middle of the Carter years, and inflation was really galloping. It was out of control. And then inflation was choked off under Reagan. The peak of inflation was just a year or so into the Reagan administration, 1982, and then inflation essentially went into a sharp decline and has stayed very low, really for 30 years. When Biden came to office, the Federal Reserve set its inflation target at 2%. Now, 2% inflation is not bad. Why? Because economies typically grow at 2%, 2.5%. So if you have an inflation rate that is very moderate and roughly matches the growth in the economy, then you're not really doing something very destructive. It's not a bad thing. This is why the Federal Reserve decided that this 2% rate is actually going to be acceptable. But the inflation rate has continued to move up and move up pretty rapidly, so that it's pretty much you can see it through the podcast. Inflation has now hit 4%. Inflation has now hit 5%. Inflation is now over 6%, and I'm tracking it over 6%. And the latest data just out, inflation has now hit 7%. Now, we should realize 7%, you might say, well, wait a minute, 7% itself doesn't seem that bad. But when you look around the world, 7% is actually very high. Here are some global inflation rates. China, 1.5%. Taiwan, 2.6%. France, 2.8%. Australia, 3%. Singapore, 3.8%. Canada, 4.7%. UK, 5.1%. India, 5.6%. So the only countries that have inflation rates higher than ours, and of course there are some basket case countries that have, you know, absurd rates of inflation. Of course, the highest is Venezuela. Honey, listen to this. 1,198%.
I know.
So think about that. That means prices are going up 10 times in 1 year.
Yeah.
Argentina, 51%. Turkey, 36%. So there are countries that are higher, but the vast majority of countries and the industrialized countries are all lower, even Europe. President Trump gave us a tax cut, and the typical American family got a $2,000 benefit because of that. You have $2,000 more to save or to spend per year thanks to Trump. Well, as a result of inflation, Biden has given the typical American family a $5,000 bill. Why? Because that means if you add up all your expenses through the year and then you simply factor in the inflation factor, you realize you're basically paying $5,000 more to get the same stuff. Wow. Let's look at some specifics. Fresh fish, up 10%. Chicken, the same, 10.4%. Furniture, 13.8%. Hotels, 27.6%. Car rentals, 36%. Used cars, 37%. And gasoline up 56%. So this is a miserable economy that's been given us, not just by a miserable president, by a miserable party in office. And again, this is something that is going to send a message to the American people. Truthfully, the American people don't mind if they're okay with this. If they want to see these kinds of rates continue, they're going to obviously vote to keep Biden and the Democrats in office. But I don't think so. I think people can have pretty good gauges. And Debbie was saying, but will people really, you know, will they really know to blame this on Biden and the Democrats? And I said, listen, it's not even a matter of people being able to trace some causal relationship between Biden. The simple proposition of American politics that's been true for 100 years is really simple. If things are going well, the president gets the credit. It doesn't matter if you can prove that he actually did those things. Clinton, for example, had a roaring economy in the 1990s. He didn't really do it. It was the result of the end of the Cold War, a massive peace dividend that came out of that. It was the success of Reagan policies that continued to have a kind of aftermath continuing through the 90s. It was the result of the technological revolution, which Clinton had nothing to do with. But nevertheless, he could bask in those numbers. He could bask in that glory. The economy is going great. People, Clinton's doing an amazing job. He might be a depraved individual, but he's an excellent president. So he got the full credit. And I think by the same measure, by the same token, Biden deserves and will get the full blame. You know, I've just been talking about inflation, which is at a 40-year high. Doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And you know why? The reason for this is our government has a dirty secret. They kind of want inflation. Think about this. Right now, inflation rates are higher than the interest on treasury bonds. So with every day that passes, the government owes less on its mountain of debt. Imagine if your mortgage had a negative interest rate. Would you be in a hurry to pay it off? Exactly. So your pain is their gain. Protect your savings now. Hedge against inflation with gold from Birch Gold, because the government is sabotaging the value of the U.S. dollar. Birch Gold will help you convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by real gold. Now that's peace of mind. That's why I'm a customer. With thousands of satisfied customers and A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, you can trust Birch Gold to protect your savings. Text Dinesh to 989898. You'll get a free information kit on holding gold in a tax-sheltered account. Then call Birch and protect your hard-earned savings. Text Dinesh to 989898 to get your free information kit now. Remember Kim Potter? Kim Potter was the cop who accidentally shot Dante Wright. Dante Wright, a hardened criminal. This is a guy who was in the process of being arrested. And Kim Potter went for her taser and unbelievably got her gun out and shot Dante Wright. In any event, the trial had been going on in December. The verdict came out, I think, after the I went on vacation. So I haven't been able to discuss the Kim Potter case. But I'm thinking these days about the strange contrast between Kim Potter on the one hand and Alec Baldwin on the other. Now, let's think about these two cases for just a moment, because here's Kim Potter. She shot a violent criminal during an arrest. Here's Alec Baldwin. He shot a completely innocent woman on a movie set. Now, both shootings were accidental. Kim Potter didn't mean to do it, and Alec Baldwin didn't mean to do it. But Potter is going to prison. Now, by the way, I think this was an unjust verdict, because I think this was a mistake, not an intentional killing. And evidently, there was a holdout on the jury. The jury deliberations dragged on and on. And press reports said that one juror wept uncontrollably through the reading of the verdict. And that tells me that was the holdout juror. In fact, that was the same juror. That was a juror who realized, listen, when a policeman commits a mistake like this, it's not a criminal matter. It can be a civil matter. It could be that Kim Potter is still responsible through negligence for the loss of that man's life, because whatever Dante Wright did, he actually did not deserve to be shot, and she wasn't trying to shoot him. But why is it that Baldwin is scot-free? I mean, he hasn't even been charged. And why is Kim Potter headed to prison? That's the question I'm trying to ask. Now, one answer would be that's because Baldwin is a big Hollywood guy. We don't go after big Hollywood guys. Could that be the explanation? Possibly, although I don't think it's the main one. Here's the second one. Alec Baldwin is rich. Alec Baldwin is able to afford all kinds of top-level counsel. Kim Potter, on the other hand, is middle, even lower middle class. So this is a class issue where if you don't have the money, you can't get the lawyers, you're not going to be able to get off. I think the main factor, if you ask me, is the race of the victim. In other words, Alec Baldwin shot a white person, and Kim Potter shot Donte Wright, who's not only black, but this is actually even important. She shot a black criminal. And ironically, it's the black criminals that get the sympathies of the left. It's the black criminals that lead to the immediate cry, go get her! And I think it was the pressure to go get her that was coming, not from the public, because I think the public actually saw it for what it was, but from the media, from the cultural left. This is what got the prosecutors to say, let's go after this cop, let's make an example out of her. We realize it was an accident, but let's see if we can put her in prison. And in fact, they have put her in prison. Whereas Alec Baldwin, and again, people say, well, Alec Baldwin, you know, he didn't even know there was bullets in the gun. Well, he bears some responsibility for that because he was also the producer of the movie. So when you have someone who's the producer of the movie and the actor in question, they have managerial in addition to acting responsibility. So it's very hard to argue that Alec Baldwin deserves no blame for what happened. And my question is, if you're going to treat Kim Potter harshly, why not Alec Baldwin? Probably until now you took aches and pains as a normal part of life. You're like, wow, this just comes from getting older. This just comes because I bumped my arm or my leg. Not much I can do about it. Well, there is. There is something you can do. There's a 100% drug-free solution available to you. It's called Relief Factor. It supports your body's fight against inflammation, and inflammation is the source of aches and pains. Now, the vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more. They become regular customers. Why? Because it works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She's had this frozen shoulder problem, but Relief Factor has been a total game changer for her. She takes Relief Factor, the pain disappears, and she knows if she doesn't take it, the pain's going to come right back. So Debbie's like, I'm never going to be without this again. You too can benefit from a Relief Factor. You just try it. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. Again, that number, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. You'll feel the difference. I was fully planning to continue pushing forward with my introduction to Russian literature, but apparently my obvious enthusiasm about the greatness of Russian literature has provoked at least in one case, a little bit of blowback. And the blowback itself is interesting, so I thought I would sort of devote today's segment to addressing it head on. I'm going to read now from an email that was sent to me through my website. So this guy wasn't, I wish he had sent it in as an audio question because it would have been perfect. But nevertheless, he goes, hello, Dinesh. It's a great shame that you're calling a series on Russian literature a literature of the soul. And he goes, no, please stop. And then he goes on to say, Russian literature was written to look like Western literature so the West would get a dream of the Russian mysterious soul. And he goes, this is the soul that tortured Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, the nations of the Caucasus, and every single ethnic group whose territory they grabbed. He's referring here to the not only the sins of the Russian Empire, but also the sins of Soviet communism. And he goes, it was a prison for people. The literature seemingly spoke of abnormal murderers, while there in Russia, they are everywhere. And he then goes on to say, and he's kind of flipping back and forth here a little bit with his points. He goes, Tolstoy copied Jane Austen, Pushkin copied Byron. They only differed in choosing violent endings. Dostoevsky only wrote about violent people. You think he wanted people in Russia to change? No, Dostoevsky was crazy. That was the normalcy of how he looked at people. It's this kind of normalcy that Democrats and their leaders bring to the U.S. Don't make a mistake. So this is I've read the letter pretty much in its entirety. And I thought it's a very fascinating letter, which raises a couple of really important points. And I want to address them kind of head on, talk about why I continue to be, a fan and continue to believe that there's a depth, a psychological richness to this literature, even though it deals with a lot of very harsh and ugly topics that perhaps with a greater degree of realism and frankness than you would see in other types of literature. So let's start with this idea that Russian literature is derivative, that people are copying from the West. Now, starting about the 15th or 16th century, continuing through the 17th, what you have is a movement initiated by the Russian Tsar named Peter the Great to turn Russia westward, to embrace French and European culture, to bring that culture to Russia. And Petersburg, the great city founded by Peter the Great, was a European city and still is. I mean, you can go to St. Petersburg now and you see the enormous influence of European architecture and also European ideas. The Russians had a kind of a love-hate relationship with European literature. It's true. Pushkin, for example, does translations of Shakespeare, and he also develops plots that are partly seem to be miniaturized versions of scenes in Shakespeare. So there's a clear, I would say, very open borrowing of Shakespeare. Now, Tolstoy is a little bit of a different character. At one point, Tolstoy excoriated another Russian novelist by saying, "You're worse than Shakespeare." And so Tolstoy is kind of implying that Shakespeare was some kind of a terrible playwright. Tolstoy is basically saying that this Russian guy's plays are bad, are as bad or worse than Shakespeare. Now, let me turn to the more serious issue of the of violence and murder and very ugly things. And it's certainly true that Russia has done horrible things to the small countries around it. Think, for example, of the Russian treatment of Poland. Well, this was the Soviet treatment of Poland in the aftermath of the Second World War. Think about Russia swallowing up the Ukraine. And these crimes, some of them, did go back to the Tsars. This is not something that was just started by the Soviets. There was a very interesting debate in the 1980s when I first came to Washington, D.C., between two groups of Sovietologists. On the one hand, you had Sovietologists like Richard Pipes. By the way, Richard Pipes is the father of Daniel Pipes, the scholar I've had on this podcast. Richard Pipes was one of the leading Sovietologists in the country, taught at Harvard, as well as Pipes' colleague, a man named Adam Ulam, who was of Polish descent. So Pipes and Ulam took the view that the crimes of the Soviet Union were a continuation of the crimes of the Russian soul. In other words, the Russians are a murdering bunch of people. They were that way under the Tsars. They're that way under the Soviets. It's not all that different. There's a straight line that sort of connects Russian history to sort of rapine and murder. On the other hand, you have people like Solzhenitsyn, who I think with greater accuracy say that, yes, there were all kinds of crimes committed under the Tsars. After all, there was serfdom in Russia under the Tsars. Think about it. There was a single family in Russia in the early 1860s that owned, and I'm not making this number up, 3 million serfs. One family owns 3 million serfs. There's nothing even in American slavery to compare with this kind of power. Imagine having a sort of sovereignty over the lives of 3 million people. Serfdom was extremely cruel, but of course it was a Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, who abolished serfdom. And Solzhenitsyn's point was that, listen, for all the crimes of the Tsars, this is not the same thing as Soviet communism. Soviet communism introduced a level of industrial slaughter. Of course, we did have parallels to that in Nazi Germany. We saw parallels to that in Mao's China. But this is really the comparison. These are modern atheistic regimes that inflicted this kind of carnage. And it's not fair to directly connect this to the Russian Orthodox Church or to the Tsars, who are a very mixed bunch. On the one hand, you have Ivan the Terrible. On the other hand, you have Nicholas II. So you had, if you will, cruel Tsars and more benign Tsars. Obviously, they were all authoritarian, but to different degrees. Now, the other point to remember about the Russians is that they were not only invaded, they were not only invaders, they were also invaded. They were not only the pulverizers, they were also the pulverized. In fact, if you go back through Soviet, well, to pre-Soviet history, you basically see that in earlier centuries, and I'm thinking here from about the 10th century to about the 15th century, the Russians were actually rarely in control of their own fate. Russia began with Kiev, the city of Kiev, and some surrounding cities that were collectively called Rus. Well, those cities were constantly under siege. Kiev is in a kind of open territory. It was always being invaded by the Tatars. It was being invaded by the Mongols. It was invaded by all kinds of alien people. There was a time when even Poland was invading Russia, and there was a Polish Tsar who sat on the Russian throne. Now, eventually there was an uprising. The man was overthrown. He was killed. In fact, his head was shot out of a cannon in the direction of Poland. So there's a very violent history here. But the point is that it took a long time. In fact, it took until Ivan the Terrible, when Russia was able to break the force of the Tatars, was able to break the force of external invaders, and then the sort of center of Russia, which had moved from Kiev to what was then called Moskva, because it was the Moscow River, now called Moscow, of course, and Moscow since then became the center of Russia. Now, What about the complicity of people like Dostoevsky of Tolstoy? Were they crazy? Were they advocates of murder? Were they basically demented psychos? Now look, there's an element of craziness in these Russian novelists, particularly Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I would say that Turgenev, the third of that troika, was a much more balanced figure. Turgenev was always trying to sort of, on the one hand, defend ancient Slavic culture at its best, at the same time to embrace science and modernity. He was trying to find that balance between the sort of two forces that were pulling in different directions in Russia. With Dostoevsky, what you get is a guy who's, I think, very crazy streak enables him to see sort of deeper than most ordinary people into the soul. And this is kind of what I'm getting at. There's a line in the philosopher Nietzsche that's very revealing. He says that most things that we think about other people, we don't really admit to ourselves. And Nietzsche gives the example of a relative. He says, all your life you go through your life thinking, that guy was a great guy. I really like him. He's really interesting. He's really funny. I enjoy his company and so on. And then Nietzsche says, what happens if the guy suddenly dies and you come into an inheritance? Nietzsche goes, suddenly you realize you're relieved that the guy died. Why? Because that facilitated your inheritance. Suddenly you realize that you're perfectly happy to dispose of the guy. You don't care about him that much. It's his money that will make you happier than he ever could. And so suddenly this emotion of relief, which shows you, wow, you know, this is a kind of depraved and disgusting aspect of human nature, but there it is, and it's in you, and you would never have known it if you weren't attentive to what your immediate reaction was. Not your pretend reaction, not your what you say later at the funeral, but what you actually thought when you first found out. And so this is what Russian literature is really good at. It's really good at catching you out in your true feelings. Your true feelings, not just about inheritance, but also about adultery, about murder. So Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, they take these, I would call them forbidden zones of the human soul, and they don't hesitate to go there. And that's what makes the literature, I think, particularly deep, particularly interesting, because not because it is in complicity with evil, but because in some ways, I think, in revealing evil in its full macabre ferocity, it enables us to understand it and in the process also understand ourselves.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.